The unemployment numbers stay steady at 8.2%.
And what does Obama's top economic advisor have to say? Hello, everybody. I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. It is Friday, the 6th of July. Coming up, we're going to have all the news you need to hear about the big jobs report today from the Labor Department, which was pretty disappointing, according to a lot of economists.
And other stuff on the jobs theme. We'll talk about jobs for North Koreans. And for those who do have a job, we're going to look at something called stack rating that could well be the bane of your existence, even if you don't know exactly what it's called. That's coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
It's that special day each month when we digest the latest employment numbers from the Department of Labor. The economy added 80,000 non-farm jobs in June. The unemployment rate did not move. It's still at 8.2%. And investors are a little disappointed, aren't they, Jeremy?
That's right. At the time we are recording this podcast, the stocks in the U.S. are down about 1%. Oil has dropped 3%, and the yield on the 10-year T-note is down to down about 2.5% at 1.56, which is an indication that investors are definitely worried about throwing their money into any kind of equities.
So let's get a little response and analysis from the Obama administration. Alan Krueger is chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Good to talk with you.
Good morning, Jeff.
So I heard one economist this morning charitably describe today's job numbers as weird. Certainly, at the least, you can't be particularly happy about them.
You know, when the job numbers come in every month, I try to take a step back and look at the jobs report in the context of other information we're getting about the economy, longer-run trends. Mm-hmm. And we see that for the past 28 months, the private sector has added jobs, a total of 4.4 million over that period. Some months stronger than others. We would like to strengthen the pace of job growth, but I think we see a picture of an economy that is healing from a very deep wound that was inflicted by the financial crisis and severe recession that followed.
I know that you want Congress to pick up the president's jobs bill, but let's just adopt the fairly safe presumption that Congress is not likely to do much for you stimulus-wise. In that case, what kind of policy advice can you give the president right now?
Well, you might count me as an optimist, but I do hope that Congress will do the right thing and take the steps that it can take to strengthen job growth. The president submitted the American Jobs Act with a number of proposals that independent economists have said would strengthen job growth.
Right. Well, I hear you, but it's not likely to happen. So what is within the president's purview at the moment in terms of action?
Well, first of all, sometimes Congress does act in the interest of the American people. We saw that with the student loan interest rates, a bill the president's going to sign later today. But the president can also take actions on his own, such as by making it easier for families to refinance their mortgages. And he has actively pursued his administrative authority, such as helping families to refinance. And in fact, what he would like to do is to expand refinancing so families could take advantage of the low interest rates. And we are now asking Congress for more authority to help families to do more refinancing.
So Mitt Romney has said this morning what you would expect in response to these numbers, that they're very disappointing. But he also said something about the many Americans who are stuck in jobs below their skill level. And you were at the Aspen Ideas Festival last week talking about sort of the same thing. You called it a middle-class jobs deficit. Define that for me.
Well, we have faced a jobs problem in the U.S. for a very long time period. That's one of the reasons why middle-class families were under so much stress and why they needed to borrow so much to maintain their consumption. Then the recession that began at the end of 2007 made the middle-class jobs deficit much, much worse. And now there's a big deficit to fill in terms of job growth. That's why I think it's very important that we stay on the path of creating more jobs each month. And as I mentioned, we'd like to do more to strengthen the pace of job growth.
Alan Krueger, chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors and professor of economics at Princeton, thanks very much.
Thank you, Jeff.
And let's get some analysis on the jobs number now from David Kelly. He's chief global strategist with J.P. Morgan Funds. He's with us now from Boston to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, what's your reaction to this jobs report?
Well, it was predictably depressing. We did get 80,000 jobs. It's a little bit less than people had thought. There are some silver linings. We saw some increase in temporary workers. We saw some increase in the average work week and in average hourly earnings. But overall, you have to say that the economy is growing very, very slowly right now.
And why do you think that is? Why are we seeing such slow growth at the moment?
Well, there are a few things. I mean, one of them is that we're bringing our deficit down. You know, a few years ago, our federal budget deficit was 10.2% of GDP. This year, it's going to be about 7.5%. But bringing that down actually exerts a drag on the economy. We've got less government spending, and I think that's one of the things that's dragging on the economy. And also, there's just so much uncertainty. I mean, we don't know what tax rates are going to be next year. We don't know when we're going to get back to normal interest rates. I think all that uncertainty causes people to wait and see. And, of course, wait and see are the three most damaging words for the economy overall.
Well, it's interesting that you didn't mention the word Europe there when you talked about the reasons for this. Don't you think we can blame Europe a little bit for our problems over here?
Not really. I mean, I was looking at some numbers, and in the first 4 months of this year, our exports overall are up about 6%. That's okay. And in fact, we only export about 2% of our GDP to the Eurozone. So it is having some impact on confidence. But I think mostly our problems in the United States are homegrown. We're lacking confidence, and we're lacking any direction with regard to monetary and fiscal policy.
Well, what would you have Washington do then, David?
Well, I think the Federal Reserve needs to lay out a path back towards normal interest rates. This morphine drip of more and more quantitative easing, it just isn't working. If people know that interest rates are going to go up, then they'll get going on borrowing money and lending money to take advantage of current low rates. And then the federal government, I mean, we don't know what tax rates are next year, and both parties need to get together and lay out not just what tax rates are going to be next year, but where they're going to be over the next 10 years. We need to know how we get back to some sort of budget discipline here, but do it gradually. But we need to reduce uncertainty. I think Washington, more than anything else, they can't fix the economy through their actions, but they can help the economy a lot by reducing uncertainty.
David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist with J.P. Morgan Funds. Thanks very much.
Anytime.
So today's numbers offer us a snapshot of the economy. Even looking over the last few months doesn't give us the true long-term trend. For that, here's our wealth and poverty reporter, Chrissy Clark, with one trend that she says is shaped like the letter U.
By U-shaped, economists mean high and low-skilled jobs have been doing okay since the 1990s.
It's the middle that has seen the weakest demand.
That's economist Gary Bertless with Brookings. Imagine an office building, maybe one you're headed to right now. Demand for a job like janitor Maynor Padilla's, who I found rummaging for a ladder in a supply closet, demand for his kind of low-skilled, low-wage job has been good.
Has there been any cuts to the cleaning staff here?
No, that's good.
As Bertless the economist explains,
you can't do it long distance from Shanghai.
And up in the corner offices, high-skilled, high-income jobs are doing just fine, too. It's the middle-level jobs, things like manufacturing and, to stick to our office metaphor, tech and customer support that have been disappearing to places like India.
Thank you for calling the leader in PC support. My name is Harry. How may I help you?
And to robots.
I'd like to look up your information.
And economists say no one really knows how long this U-shaped economy might last. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
So as this employment report continues to show some stagnant growth, slow growth, a lot of politicians, experts, and economists are chiming in about the best ways to solve the unemployment problem in the United States. But one economist sees a solution inspired by Germany, and it might surprise you, we should work fewer hours.
Huh. Well, Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive think tank, and he is here to talk about that idea for today's Midday Extra. Dean, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure. So you wrote this piece in The Guardian that said instead of worrying necessarily about increasing demand, everyone should just work shorter hours like the Germans. What's the argument?
Well, the basic story of this downturn is that we're producing too much in some sense. So the whole idea is that we don't have enough demand in the economy, and that means we have people going unemployed. So in effect, we're suffering because we're too wealthy, too productive. So, you know, the answer people have been focused on, can we have more stimulus? Can we somehow get the private sector to grow more? That's all well and good, but the reality is that's not happening. So can we go the other way and say, okay, why don't we all just work a little bit less? And in effect, make up much of the lost wages with subsidies from the government. That's kind of what unemployment insurance is about. People don't work and they get a paycheck or a check from the government. The idea here is, how about we work less and have the government make up part of the loss?
So we're relying on the government more, in your view. That's how we get out of this?
Well, it's in some sense relying on government the same amount, because what happens now is people lose their job and they get an unemployment check, and I'm saying it would be much better if instead of people losing their job and getting paid for not working at all, suppose they cut back their hours by 20% and they had half of the lost wages made up by the government.
Based on my limited knowledge of the German economy, something else that's critical there is that they have very strong but also somewhat acquiescent or cooperative unions. And so they hold wages down, which means that instead of having to lay people off, companies are able to actually pay people less in a recession. People don't lose their jobs. Could that be a part of the package as well, maybe?
You know, it's hard to import a structure directly from Germany to the U.S., but certainly you'd be looking to have, you know, some give and take, because the idea here is we're trying to keep people on the job. And the fact is workers, both union and non-union workers, have indicated in this downturn in the past they're often willing to make concessions where they're needed. You know, look at what happened with the GM and Chrysler bailouts. You know, the UAW made many concessions in terms of wages and benefits in order to keep the companies alive.
But isn't your idea easier said than done? I mean, to have the government determine that you were working more hours and now are working fewer hours, and therefore they should make up the difference, or, you know, who should be allowed to work fewer hours? If you're going to get the same paycheck if you work 4 days a week as you do if you work 5 days a week, then what's the point of working 5 days a week?
Well, a couple of things. First off, people won't get the same paycheck. They'd be getting some cut in pay. But the second thing is the government won't be doing it. It's just like it is now. Employers, when they see less demand for labor, the point is now they look to lay off workers. The idea here is say, okay, how about we encourage you, instead of you lay off workers and have us pick up the tab with unemployment insurance, you cut back hours and we pick up part of the lost wages. Now, I should point out this is actually already in law. There are 23 states, including California and New York, that actually already have short work programs as part of their unemployment insurance system. And in fact, that's actually promoted in legislation passed earlier this year, the extension of the payroll tax cut. The federal government picks up the tab for those short work programs for the next 2 years. So this already is in law. I just would like to see it hugely expanded. The take-up rate in that's fairly low. I think it'd be great to see that hugely expanded, because I think that's a much better story than people being laid off and getting unemployment checks.
The productivity of American workers has just ratcheted up and up and up and up. And I think we passed Japan not too long ago for the number of hours that we work in a week. Americans are just extremely hard workers, I guess. Maybe it's in our nature. Maybe we have to get by these days. But how does sort of American productive desire play into your plan?
Well, you know, I'm not telling people whether to work hard or work less hard. The issue here is we have an institutional structure that tends to promote longer hours. The big issue here is our health insurance, which is generally still a per-person cost. For the longest time, it was a per-worker cost. And what that meant was companies had a very big incentive to have their workers work longer hours, even paying them time and a half overtime or double time in some cases, rather than hire another worker and have that overhead cost of health care. I remember one of the last strikes at General Motors back in the 90s was over the issue of forced overtime. Workers wanted the option to refuse overtime, and GM wouldn't give in on it. They were willing to give the workers more money, but they were saying, if we need you more hours, you have to work that. So you have very high overhead costs per worker in the U.S. in a way that you don't have in most other countries, and that really pushes things towards having workers work longer hours.
How many hours a week do you work, Dean?
You don't want to know.
Too many.
Are you willing to cut them back? Maybe lead by example.
You know, I don't get paid for them. I wish I didn't have to work so many hours. Let me put it that way.
Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive think tank, and he's got an interesting solution to a very complicated problem that we're all trying to figure out, which is unemployment. Dean Baker, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And for more on attitude differences between Americans and European workers and vacation time, check out this week's Marketplace Money podcast.
And now to something completely different. In Milford, Massachusetts, Jeff, there's a guy who paid off his mortgage with pennies.
God bless him.
According to the Milford Daily News, he and his wife went down to the bank. They dropped off more than 62,000 pennies that he's been collecting ever since he came up with this idea.
Whoa.
35 years ago. The bank says he did a great job. Every roll of pennies was counted perfectly. And he says that his advice to others, which I loved, is When you say you're going to do something, do it.
Follow your dreams. You can achieve your goals.
Indeed.
Cartman said that, I think. How much did it weigh? Did it say?
It was 2 400-pound boxes, I believe.
Dang. And he rolled them himself rather than
he
going into—
He rolled them himself. No, it was a few pennies a day, all of those 35
years. Oh, I see. Because I was saying, my bank has one of those machines that'll do that in a few seconds. But,
yeah, really.
But, you know, that sounds like an adventure. We've had lots of numbers today, jobs numbers and stock market numbers. Here's— 2 brief meditations on the number 13. First of all, that's the age of a computer programmer who was arrested in Japan under the country's harsh anti-hacking laws. So in Japan, you don't have to actually spread a virus. All you have to do is make it and have it on your computer. And that's against the law. And such was the case with this kid, which is why this has become a little bit controversial, because what did he really do when he's 13? Congratulations to Manitoba. For 13 straight years now, crowned the Slurpee drinking capital of the world. 7-Eleven. I'm sure they are so proud.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Speaking of jobs again, but going in a little different direction, the other day on its website, Vanity Fair previewed an article they have coming up about life at Microsoft. And it details a particular human resource practice that drove employees there up the wall, apparently, something that's called stack rating. Have you ever heard that term, Jeremy?
No, I haven't.
It was new to me. A stack rating this week has become kind of a trending term. And so to help us with it, I've got Brenda Ellington Booth here. She's at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. And thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
So at Microsoft, it sounds like it operated kind of like a quota system. A small number of employees were to be rated great, a much larger number rated mediocre, and a certain number had to be rated poor. I can see why employees might not be crazy about that. Can you?
Absolutely. A lot of it just has to do with the population of employees that you hire. If you're trying to hire the best people, and there's only a small percentage of people at that very top, then you have people working really, really hard that are very talented, and it's almost like slicing an eyelash in terms of who makes it and who doesn't.
How widespread is it?
It kind of ebbs and flows. I think when you have a bad economy, you know, it comes back because it's a way to weed people out, and then people feel kind of the backlash of it, and then it goes away, and then it comes back. And so right now, I think it's a bit on the rise because companies are feeling pressure to have to be very specific about hiring and rewarding only just a limited amount of people and letting people go, if you will.
Now, I've also heard stack rating defended on budget grounds, saying that you can't give raises to everybody and we have to preserve our budget.
Yeah, and that is definitely a reality, and you have to figure that out. I think where people, employees, feel a lot of bad feelings about it is HR, senior management, comes up with, you know, well, we're going to do the top 10%, and only the top 10% are going to get the bigger raises, and everyone else gets nothing or very little. People feel that is out of their control, and it feels rather arbitrary.
Brenda Ellington Booth at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, following last week's big Supreme Court ruling on health care, states have a choice about whether to expand their Medicaid programs, which provide health care to the poor. And a number of them, including Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina, say they won't. That is worrying for hospitals, as Dan Gorenstein reports now from New Hampshire Public Radio.
John Hawkins is the lobbyist for the Texas Hospital Association, and he expects members to kick in hundreds of thousands of dollars for their lobbying campaign.
I think it will be as aggressive as anything else we've done, probably more aggressive.
Why? Hospitals eat costs for the uninsured. In 2010, Texas hospitals swallowed $4.6 billion. But that argument isn't flying in about a quarter of states. New Hampshire House Speaker Bill O'Brien says it's just too expensive.
For states to expand Medicaid voluntarily would be like booking tickets on the Titanic.
Hospitals dropped millions in the last presidential election and are big employers. But that's not enough in the reddest states, says Tom Scully, former Medicare director.
I'd be stunned to see Southern conservative governors take the money because I think their conservative base is much stronger in those states than the hospital lobbies are.
Scully says in these states, political consequences trump everything else. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On this big jobs day, let's talk about jobs for someone other than Americans. How about jobs for North Koreans? Now, North Korea does not export very much. They're a pretty closed economy. But we're hearing this week about a plan for the Hermit Kingdom to export one resource it does have in abundance, people. North Korea has started exporting workers to China next door. Sean Ryan is with me now from Shanghai, and he's managing director of the China Market Research Group. Hi, Sean.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
What kind of jobs will these North Koreans be doing in China?
Well, China has been facing a labor crunch over the last several years because younger Chinese workers are no longer to slave away in factories for low-cost wages. So what's happening is the Chinese government is importing tens of thousands of North Korean workers to really work in low-wage manufacturing jobs in factories in northeast China.
Any idea what they're going to be making? Is this a particular industry where this sort of labor exchange arrangement is being inaugurated?
They're going to be working in several different types of factories. Part of it will be seamstresses, low-end textiles, as well as some of the heavy industry manufacturing, and heavy equipment, which is in the Northeast China region.
What's in this for North Korea?
I think for North Korea, it's important because they need to get hard currency. Right now, the North Korean government is fairly unstable. It's basically bankrupt, and they need to get Korean workers to be able to get more money into the state coffers because the workers are only going to get a small percentage of any compensation they earn, and the vast majority of it is going to go to the government.
One thing that China, biggest country on earth, should not be short of, you would think, is people. So what's in this for China?
It's sort of counterintuitive for China, but because of the one-child policy, when workers retire, there are just fewer and fewer people that are available to work in factories. The second thing is because of Leon Panetta's pivot towards Asia for the U.S. defense, China is very worried about instability in North Korea and reunification between the North and South because that would put an American ally right on China's borders. So China is going to do whatever it can to prop up the North Korean regime and really create a buffer zone against the United States.
Sean Ryan with the China Market Research Group, also the author of The End of Cheap China, Economic and Cultural Trends That Will Disrupt the World. Thanks very much.
Great to be here.
So I think the best way for me to introduce our next guest is to play you a bit of one of her songs.
And I'll see your true colors shining through. I'll see your true colors. That's why I love you.
That's Cyndi Lauper, of course, with her hit True Colors, which came out back in 1986. Well, these days, Lauper is working on a project called the True Colors Fund, which deals with homelessness among gay youth. And one of the fund's first initiatives is to raise awareness of the issue. Cyndi Lauper joins me now here in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first, tell us just about this problem that you're trying to address. You say 40% of young people who are homeless in this country are LGBT.
Up to 40%. And the reason I was so concerned is because only 3 to 5% of the general youth population identify as gay or transgender, which means they're getting thrown out.
Thrown out of their houses.
Just thrown out of their houses, thrown out of every place, just because they're gay or transgender. That's like throwing your child out because he has brown hair or she has brown hair.
What got you involved in this in the first place?
They're kids. You don't throw kids away. You know, funny thing, the kids, I had a kid. He didn't come with a money-back guaranteed receipt. You know what I mean? Like, if I didn't like him, I couldn't bring him back.
But was there a moment that you decided to do this because of an experience that you had?
You know, I had a friend who died very young, actually of AIDS. He was thrown out of his house when he was 12 by his mom.
Wow.
And unfortunately, all the things that happen to you when you're a teenager, because you're a teenager, are magnified. So what's better is to have information, because the more information and educated that you are about your situation, the better you can proceed to help your child. So this program brings all the family in, and they all talk.
Have you faced any pushback from any of your fans with a stance like this?
No, I don't think about that.
Hmm.
You know, I've been around a long time, And I do things, I make music to lift people up. And if I see kids in need like this, see, this is a fixable epidemic. If you reach out to the families and they can talk to each other with educated people and get it all out, then it's fixable. If it's not fixable, that's fine. But you don't throw away a generation. And that's why I'm so adamant about this. And yes, I'm going to advocate my ass off for these kids.
Well, Cindy Lauper, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Finally, this weekend in Dallas, you can catch the first ever Miss Conservative U.S. pageant. Contestants will exemplify, according to the website, God-given personal freedoms, parentheses, with limited government intrusion, morality, and a stalwart work ethic. And so it has the usual sort of pageantry associated with it. Events include fitness wear, evening wear, and an event called Patriot Wear. It's not clear exactly what that means. It suggests maybe flag-related attire. And I guess I would say that any woman who can successfully work an outfit of stars and horizontal stripes deserves an award of some sort.
Well, if you don't want to go to the Miss Conservative USA pageant, you could head over to Houston, where something completely different is happening. And I want to just play you a little bit of what you might expect tonight from the Houston Symphony. Now, if that does not ring a bell, you probably haven't played an old school Nintendo in a while. So let me play something that might be a little closer to what you remember.
All right. Now, that I know.
Yep. What is it?
That's The Legend of Zelda, man.
It's The Legend
of Zelda. This is my childhood
right
there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the Houston Symphony is going to be playing songs from The Legend of Zelda while scenes from it are projected on a screen behind the orchestra. And tonight's performance was actually a late addition to the schedule because the one that they had scheduled for tomorrow night sold out completely. So there you go. Very popular idea.
They're up to all kinds of crazy things in Texas.
Don't mess with them. Don't mess with them.
But go there to have a good time.
Indeed. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.